Next case for argument is O'Kunley v. Gonzalez. Mr. Mandel?
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Aaron Mandel on behalf of Petitioner Beatriz O'Kunley. The only issue in this appeal is whether the Board gave cogent reasons for finding the petitioner's fear of FGM unreasonable. And the Board only gave two reasons that the government even defends in this appeal. First, that the background materials didn't specifically support her claim. And second, that her fear is unreasonable because her husband has apologized and repented. Even the government sees how weak these arguments are, and so it engages in a disingenuous attempt to bring the IJ's decision under review. But this Court's cases have consistently held that the IJ's decision is only relevant if the Board specifically adopts it. And that's what the regulations hold, and that's also what the commentary to the regulations hold. But the government quotes one piece of the commentary out of context that says that the both decisions are relevant. But what the whole quote actually says is that both decisions are relevant when the Board specifically adopts and modifies the IJ's decision. And the government doesn't even contend that that's what happened here. Back to the Board's two reasons for denying asylum here. First, the Board said that her fear is objectively unreasonable because the background materials don't specifically support it. But the government concedes that the background materials don't foreclose her claim either. And so this Court's decision in Agbor back in May shows that that argument doesn't work. In Agbor, the petitioner feared FGM. The Board skipped to the background materials without discussing her testimony or her documents. And then denied her claim because the background materials were found generally contradictory. And this Court granted the petitioner's petition for review, holding that general language is insufficient to overcome specific testimony. Now, the government suggests only one reason that Agbor is even distinguishable, and that's, according to the government, that the petitioner's testimony in this case wasn't sufficiently detailed. But that wasn't a finding that either the IJ or the Board made. The government's nitpicking in any event because petitioner testified in ample detail to establish her claim. She said that her husband's family in Nigeria has a particular practice of circumcising or inflicting FGM on women who haven't yet had the procedure performed after the birth of a male heir. She testified that as soon as she gave birth to a male heir, her husband's family began to threaten to do this to her, but for a while her husband promised to protect her. But then when he was threatened with the loss of his inheritance, he ceased to protect her, and that's enough to establish her claim. In addition, she testified that he's apologized.
There was no credibility finding here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Against your client. It was one of those decisions that assumed her credibility, but
correct.
Found her testimony and corroboration insufficient to establish the claim, right?
That's correct, unfortunately, yes.
And we have more than just her testimony here. We've got some documentary evidence from a couple of pastors in Nigeria, I think.
That's correct,
mistaken.
And also somebody who identifies himself as her family's lawyer. And they were all generally supportive of her claim and corroborated certain details, and they were basically undiscussed by the Board and the IJ, as was any faults that they might have perceived in her testimony. The only other ground that the Board suggests and that the government defends for denying her asylum boils down to the following. They concede that she has a subjective fear of FGM, but they figure she's crazy because her husband has since apologized for failing to protect her.
Is the father-in-law alive now or dead?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. All I know is that in the record, as of the date of the Board's decision, he was still alive.
Well, wouldn't that help you if you found that out one way or the other?
Well,
the problem wouldn't be there if he were deceased at this age, at 90 years of age.
If he was deceased, then the issue of the inheritance would be resolved. But
right.
I would say that he's... just because the husband has promised to protect her, we'd be crazy to believe
him.
Well,
have you done anything to look into the problem to see whether he is or is not deceased?
Well, I would just say that
I just asked you that. Can you answer that?
can answer. Can we look into whether he is or isn't?
I said yes. Why haven't you?
I just didn't think it was relevant, Your Honor, because we can't trust the husband to protect her anymore, regardless of whether her husband is deceased or not.
Wouldn't you know who would have inherited it then?
Yes, we would.
Well, all right. Wouldn't that help solve your problem?
No, I don't believe she would be safe in any event, Your Honor. Even if her husband had or had not inherited, if that issue had been resolved, her family still wants her circumcised. This was just the leverage they were trying to use to get the husband to bend to their will. Once he's already shown that he's willing to sacrifice her health and safety...
And his problem was that he wanted to inherit that land.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
And his problem was that he wanted to inherit it.
But yeah, clearly doesn't value her health or safety enough to protect her from his family members if he's willing to, for the sake of a mere inheritance, to sacrifice her in this procedure.
Was the one who was involved in it?
Her father was one of the family members that was trying to get the husband to concede to this this procedure. But there's other family members involved too, and they there's no reason to think that they will stop just because the inheritance
is happening. Family, not just the inheritance.
That's what that's in the record. Yes, Your Honor. The whole family is against her, and only her husband was ever on her side and offered to protect her. But he clearly doesn't value her health or safety enough, to trust him. He's basically.
That's all right if you're not interested in that.
Okay. I'd just like to say further.
Is he other wives or just this one?
Not that I'm aware of. He has no other wives. But he's to the extent that the government thinks it's relevant that he's apologized, I would just say we'd be crazy to believe him. When a woman flees domestic violence in this country and her husband calls her and says on the phone, "I apologize. I won't do it anymore." Do we say she's crazy for not believing him? On the contrary, we think she'd probably be crazy to go back into such a situation, and that, I think, is analogous to what's happening here. The government's argument is very weak on that score.
Where are the children? Do you know?
I'm sorry,
where are her children?
I believe they're with her husband. That's at least at the time of the hearing and the board's decision, they were
a son and a daughter?
A son and a daughter, correct.
Was the daughter subjected to this procedure?
She hadn't, but she was asked about that at the IJ hearing, and she said that the daughter had not, to her knowledge, been. And she talks to them, so. If the court has no further questions, we'll rest on our briefs with the remainder, with respect to the remainder of our arguments, and save the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mandel. Ms. Walls?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kelly Walls for the respondent, the Attorney General. The record in this case does not compel the conclusion.
So does the board's opinion supersede or supplement the immigration judges?
I think in this case, opposing counsel is correct. It was not the board did not explicitly adopt and affirm the immigration judge's decision. However, both the board and the immigration judge both reached the same conclusion, that Ms. Oyenkule's claim was not objectively reasonable.
The board's reasoning is pretty deficient because first it sets out the reasons why she has this concern, and then it relies on these country reports, which don't really bear on the issue, right? They just say, yeah, sometimes they do this, sometimes not. Conditions are improving. Who knows? That's extremely vague. And then they have some speculation about her family. But if you believe her testimony, I don't understand what there is. And as Judge Sykes pointed out, the board doesn't question her truthfulness. So what exactly is there on the other side?
I think that this court's recent decision in Agbor is really instructive on that point. In that case, they did find an FGM claim to be objectively reasonable on the basis of testimony alone. But if you look at what was claimed and what was testified...
Answer my question. I'm not interested in Agbor. What in this case offsets her testimony?
Her testimony itself is somewhat undercut by her claim that she now...
Just focus on what the board said, not your own views.
No, I'm trying to, Your Honor. On page 4 of the record, it's page 3 of the board's decision, they actually say, additionally, the husband's repentance is also significant in that the respondent testified he was the person who protected her from being circumcised by his relatives throughout their marriage. The government is not suggesting in any way that Ms. Oyenkunle is crazy. Rather, that her husband had a momentary lapse of judgment. He, for 10 years, protected her from FGM. Then, apparently under pressure from his family, decided to tell her she needed to go and undergo this procedure. After she left,
But how good is his protection if he's willing to trade her, so to speak, for an inheritance? That doesn't suggest a very robust commitment to sparing her from this procedure.
Well, I think that actually highlights another problem with this case, is that her testimony was so lacking in specificity or detail that we don't really know what the husband said or did or threatened to do. We don't know really what her interaction with his family was. That's why I was trying to direct the court's attention to Agbor, where you look at that testimony was so specific that she visited her, that the Agbor visited her parents in their village on one occasion where she was told that she had to undergo this procedure. On three occasions...
Maybe that's a stronger case, but I don't understand how that bears on... So all the boy says, the husband's repentance is significant. Well, significant about what?
He did protect her for 10 years. Also, they found her testimony insufficient.
He protected her until he saw he might get some money from unprotecting her. Well, doesn't that make her... So she goes back, and maybe the family says to him,
There is also no evidence in the record that...
As Judge Coffey asked, if the father-in-law is still alive, then... He still has this interest in his inheritance.
Well, exactly.
And when against her, against his regard for her.
And when her son was born in 1992, her father-in-law was 80 and apparently already owned the property he was concerned about disposing, yet there was, for those 10 years after the birth of their son, he still was willing, apparently, to forego his inheritance until something, we don't know what, changed in 2001.
It doesn't matter what changed. The fact is, at some point, he decides the inheritance may be more important. That certainly doesn't provide very, very much protection for her going back there.
Well, even if we look to the background materials, there's nothing to suggest...
I'm particularly troubled by the reference to these country reports, which is where the board starts out.
As opposing counsel indicated, the background reports do not provide any specific support for Ms. Oyenkunle's very specific claim that the Edo tribe circumcised the wife of the eldest son after giving birth to a male heir.
It's not that the country reports support her. It's that they don't support the contrary. All the country reports show is that these practices are, intermittent. They're technically illegal, but they're carried on anyway, less so among Christians than among Muslims. But
notably, they do not show any tie between FGM and primogeniture. There's no indication that this is ever done in order for someone to inherit or to allow a husband to inherit.
But they're believing her testimony. They're believing her testimony, which is that the father-in-law, for whatever reason, considers this a possible swap, the land for the FGM.
They believe her testimony, and that satisfies...
How do country reports read on that?
I'm sorry?
Country reports don't contradict her testimony.
They don't contradict her testimony, but they provide no support for her specific claim.
But they believe her testimony.
They believe her testimony, and that satisfies the subjective
component. If they
believe
her testimony, then her husband was given this offer by his father, right?
It satisfies her subjective fear that she needs to... Her testimony, there's no question.
Subjective fear. She's testifying about what her husband and the husband's father planning, right?
But the objective component requires that from a reasonable person standard, when looking at what she has testified to...
Nothing in the country reports bears on the plausibility of the father-in-law carrying through his threat to disinherit the the husband, right?
And so you're exactly. There's nothing about inheritance at all in the country reports relating to FGM. So when a reasonable person looks at that...
No, that's completely wrong. If the father-in-law says to the... I mean, suppose the facts are these. The father-in-law says to the husband, I really like, you know, I really want your wife to be FGM'd. So if you do that, I'll give you the land. Okay. Now, suppose that's what happened. If that's what happened, it's completely irrelevant what are in the country reports.
If she had specific detailed facts in her testimony, I would agree with you. But she doesn't. And as this court cautioned in Ahmed, relying on uncorroborated testimony...
So are you saying that the board doesn't believe that the father-in-law ever said this?
No, I think what the board is saying is that now her husband will return to his initial position that he does not support FGM and will not subject her to this.
That has nothing to do with the country reports. What the husband will do in the future has absolutely nothing to do with what's in any country report.
There's two parts of this. There's her testimony and then there's the country reports. Her testimony lacked the specific detail necessary.
Look, nothing in the country report reads on what this man will do when she goes back.
And under the substantial evidence standard, then we're left in the middle.
It's irrelevant, the country reports. They're completely irrelevant.
Okay, so if we don't look at the country reports,
well,
we have her bare claim.
The board looked at the country reports. The board seemed to think that the country reports offset her testimony.
I think they also recognized that her testimony itself, separate from the background reports, was undercut by her claim that her husband has returned to his position. So that, when we look at it objectively, for 10 years after the birth of her son, she was not harmed. If we look at that objectively, it doesn't meet the necessary well-founded fear analysis. So then the board looked to the background materials and said, okay, we don't have the specific details here, but do we find support for her claim in the background materials? And there's nothing.
I didn't say that.
The board started with an analysis on page 2 of its decision with her testimony, and then it moved to a review of the background materials. On page 3, it looked to her documentary evidence, also then again touched on her testimony.
Does it say that because her testimony was so scanty, we have to look at...
I think it's definitely not as clear as one would like, but if you look...
that's a very evasive statement.
I will...
The board didn't say that. It's not that they weren't as clear as they could be.
No, on page 2 of their decision, it says, testimony alone may suffice to meet her burden of showing a well-founded fear of persecution, provided the testimony is believable, consistent,
and
sufficiently detailed.
Right, and they did not say that it was insufficiently detailed, implausible, or incoherent.
Then on the next page, it says, her testimony alone is insufficient. A well-founded fear may be shown by proving an objective situation where persecution is a reasonable possibility, citing to the cases that require detailed facts showing good reason to fear that she'd be singled out for persecution, and that it requires a presentation of specific detailed
facts.
Where
are you looking?
Page 3 of the board's decision. It's in page 4 of the record, second paragraph down. I believe the citation to requiring specific detailed facts after saying her testimony is insufficient explains the board's reasoning for finding her testimony insufficient.
But where do they say that her testimony lacked detail?
By saying it's insufficient and then citing to the cases that say it requires specific details, I think that it's discernible that they meant that it's insufficient and that it lacks specificity and detail. There's no indication that it was a credibility issue or anything else in order to find testimony insufficient.
She offered specific detailed facts, all this stuff about the father-in-law and the husband and so on. What more could she have offered?
She could have described what they said was going to happen, where they were going to take her. There had to be some... It seems that there was just a very vague...
What do you mean, where are they going to take her?
Well, in her affidavit that was submitted with her application, she said they tried to lure her to their village... And without any other explanation, is the village nearby? Was it reasonable to expect that this was a reasonable possibility that she would be taken from Lagos to some unnamed village on unknown occasions?
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
It's lacking specificity and detail to support the objective prong of the analysis.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Ms. Walls. Mr. Mandel, does he have any time left? 3 minutes?
Your Honors, first of all, Judge Coffey, I'd just like to clarify my answer to your question earlier. We do believe that the husband's father is still alive, and that makes...
At 96 or 97?
Well, we don't have any evidence to the contrary. He was alive last we heard, and we're happy to submit a letter to that effect.
He was alive in 2001.
At the time of the board's hearing in, I believe it was 2001. Was it
according to this?
Okay, we're happy to submit a letter. We can try and find out and submit a letter to the court. But if he is still alive, that makes her claim only stronger. And if he's not, we don't believe it really substantially affects her well-founded fear. And I just want to emphasize that all she has to.
It would have been helpful to all of you had you investigated that.
I apologize, Your Honor.
And been able to advise this court.
I can offer to remedy that for you, but again, yes, I agree, Your Honor. But just want to emphasize that all that's required here is to show that her fear is well-founded, and that's not a particularly high burden. The government's unclear on what the board's decision even means, and I think that's a good enough reason to remand this case for further proceedings. We'll ask if the court does that. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you.